Hi, and welcome to a special episode of Debt Wired. I'm Andy Serby, Deputy Courts Editor, and also the host of our Legal Lens podcast, where we're going to be co-releasing this. What you're about to hear is a series of interviews done on-site and in-person from our Miami Restructuring Forum on December 9th. In these five clips, you'll hear from experts in attendance what their major lessons of 2025 were, as well as what we can expect from the restructuring market in 2026. They'll talk about a wide range of issues, from key court rulings to co-op litigation surrounding Altice to challenges in sectors including healthcare and hospitality. We really hope you enjoy the listen.
We're coming to you live from the DebtWire Restructuring Forum in Miami, and our first guest of the day is Prior Cashman's Seth Lieberman. How are you doing, Seth?
Andy, how are you?
Good. Old hat, we've done this before, but maybe not in a setting quite like this.
We have. This is face-to-face. This is fun. This is good.
So we're here at the very end of the year, and this whole event takes place on the 9th, but I'd really just love to know what your experience has been from 2025 and from the perspective of your practice. You do a lot of trustee work. What's the story of this year to you?
Yeah, the story of this year in some ways has been what I'd say a continuation of 24. Still a lot of LME talk, still a lot of LME activity. I think to the extent that it's impacted my practice, we see a lot more of that activity, both out of court, but I think what we're also seeing nowadays is how that type of activity will resort in a potential in-court experience. What do Chapter 11s look like post-LME? And so I think we're starting to see a lot more of that in 25, maybe some more in 26. But I think that's been the story for us, is continuing to react to what is now the almost default, which is an LME landscape.
And to a certain degree, this is almost the year of kind of maturation. Like towards the end of last year, we saw the CERTA ruling. And up until that point, we had them proceeding through their standard Chapter 11s. Some people thought they might have had the blueprint and all those cases have diverged. Now we've got Supreme Court decisions and circuitous appellate things going on, and God only knows what's going to happen next year.
Well, I think what practitioners have realized is that when we talk about LMEs, that it's a liability management exercise. What's Chapter 11? That's a company managing their liabilities, right? They're doing it in court as opposed to out of court. So I think what's become interesting in our practice is seeing the way of, or often possible, Chapter 11s take place after an LME. Does that mean it's a glorified 22? Does that mean it's a glorified 33? Maybe not, but it's interesting to see what the capital structure, what the cadence of the chapter looks like post-LME versus if there was never an LME in the first instance.
And I think that's an interesting perspective, because you're pitching Chapter 11 as almost a continuation of the overall activity of managing your liability. Whereas I'm sure that some of those companies at this point, they've spent tens, hundreds of millions of dollars going through all the court systems, they might consider a Chapter 11 to a degree a failure of the LME, because the whole point's not to go bankrupt.
Right. I'm sure that's one vantage point. I'm not sure that I'm a buyer into that yet. The LME, as you hear a lot of the speakers here today will say, still buys optionality, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm a buyer of that. I do believe that there are values in it. I guess from my perspective, when we look at a capital structure post-LME, it's in some ways the way I would have thought about looking at a capital structure post-Chapter 11 5 years ago. It's just now we're doing it without the guise of a bankruptcy court. And so I think what's become interesting here is that the collective community's realization that, hey, in an LME world, if that really is liability management and we really are restructuring debt here, then eventual Chapter 11s post-LME, are they really the same or similar to 22s or 33s? And what does that look like? I think there's been more of that in 25. Dare I say we may see more of that in 26. That's to be determined.
And that's the next question, which is, what do you think we're going to see in 2026? Like continuation, evolution?
I think so. I mean, look, I know that we're here to talk about themes. That's definitely one of it. I don't think there's any reason to believe as I sit here now that's going to change. I think largely unrelated, but I think whether or not we hear about it today is still the impact of what Purdue plays on in court Chapter 11s is this. We can't get past it. This is a case that filed in 2019. We're coming up on 7 years. We're coming up on a year and a half since the Supreme Court decision outlawing non-consensual third-party releases. People are still writing about it. I'm writing about it.
We're writing about it.
You're writing about it. And we can see as recent as a week or two ago from the district court in New York how it's still shifting. Everyone wants a release, understandably, under the law. how you get there, what that means, what consent looks like, and how that plays into and into Chapter 11. Really interesting, still really developing. Dare I say, we may be talking about this at the end of 26. It's not over. And so as we find ourselves in court in Chapter, I think that interplay remains very interesting.
And the opinion that you're referring to, I'm assuming, is the Golinas.
That's right.
Which is going to upend the whole thing, because for once we've seen the U.S. trustee get a win on an argument that they have, let's say charitably, that they've lost a few times over the last year and a half.
Yeah, it's an interesting decision. I have a lot of very smart colleagues out there that are able to craft plan language that can deal with that. I also think you have other jurisdictions, and even within New York, I think there's some question as to how binding is that opinion. And so I think as a result of that opinion, perhaps you get some clarity, but there I say it may provoke more questions than it provides answers.
As appellate decisions are wont to do.
Yes, exactly.
So before we lose you for the rest of the day, I would love to know what your experience has been like since you got here, but it's the start of the day. So how about what you're looking forward to today from the forum?
Look, there are no bad panels here. Let's start here. I mean, this is really just, you can throw darts at any panel here. They're all stars. It's everything that you want to be seeing in large Chapter 11. It's really interesting. Again, talking my own book here, I think the late morning panel on LMEs, and I think they call it the shifting landscapes, will be very interesting to see their take. My take is not necessarily what their take will be. So I'll be all ears there. I plan on being at all of them, and it should be a great day ahead.
Absolutely. I'm glad that we've moved into using shifting landscapes, and we've gotten away from the, I think we called all of those panels creditor on creditor violence for about 2 years. So I'm glad to see we're shaking it up. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Seth, and I hope you have a great time for the rest of the day.
Thanks so much, Andy. I appreciate it.
All right, and another edition of Live from the Miami Beach Edition at our Restructuring Forum 2025. We have Craig Russill from Winston & Strawn. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Andy. Thank you.
So, like before, we want to know what your take is on 2025 as we look to the end of the year. It's a downhill sprint to 2026. So, from the perspective of your practice, what's the story of the year for you?
So for me, we've been doing a lot of work out of court more frequently than the last 2 years than in years past. We're finding that in many industries like healthcare, commercial real estate involving hospitality, for instance, hotel owners, office buildings, that they've been plagued by the same issues industry-wide. High interest rates, high cost of operation, which includes labor. If you're in a hotel industry, you have food, right, and beverages. The insurance costs have many instances they've tripled, if not doubled. And so these outside pressures for owners of hotels and office buildings who can't just turn around and pass those increased costs onto their tenants or their customers. They have limited revenue that they can charge per room or per floor under the lease. They have to go into a restructuring mode. And I found that in these industries, hospitality again, and office buildings, that they filing bankruptcy does not usually have a good result, particularly if you don't go in well prepared with DIP financing and use of cash collateral of your existing lender. So most of my clients have been struggling to stay outside of court and to do out of court workouts with all the creditors, classes of creditors, secured, unsecured, and shareholders. And I've also seen a big increase 12 months in shareholder litigation, state court primarily, where they're suing managers of these projects, hotels, office buildings, for breach of duty, breach of contract, that basically in an effort to shift their losses to management to make themselves whole. I don't think that they're going to get very far with that, particularly where you have good operators. I'm not talking about fraudulent situations, but, and so I think the commercial real estate market is hit hard. I've had several evidentiary hearings during the year where we learned that the fact that interest rates were rising, costs of rising, is bringing values of the hotels down. So it's putting the owners of these buildings in a non-monetary default with their loan documents. So you have to deal with the lenders who want to pay down the principal because you're out of covenant. And so that starts off in the workout space. And knock on wood, so far in 25, we've been very successful with two or three turnarounds in where we've sold 4 hotels and 2 office buildings. The out-of-court's working. We just have to, we're stuck in state court litigation with shareholders, but we'll deal with that in due course. And then the other industry we've been heavily involved in is healthcare. And I think that assisted living facilities and hospital chains like Steward Hospital in Texas, I've represented purchasers of assets in Steward and also been involved in some investigations that are being conducted against the former officers and directors of Stewards.
I read that complaint.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, that's an industry that's got to have undergo some type of a change. And I still think that there are going to be issues that persisted. They reared their ugly head, I'd say, in 2023, 2024, rolled into 25, and hopefully get resolved in 26. That's what I've been seeing and doing in primarily in 2025.
Speaking of 2026, do you have any real expectation for things to change, or do you think it's going to be more of the same? Because like healthcare in particular, the legal landscape, even from the top down, the regulatory body is undergoing changes right now, reimbursement rates, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And not to jump ahead but of your questioning, but I'm looking forward to the healthcare panel this afternoon. I'm sure I will learn a lot about what's going on in that regulatory side of things. I don't focus on that. I get asked to deal with the now and then in the current situations and in these folks who operate these facilities, mostly on the borrower side, is who I've been representing in the healthcare side for troubled healthcare companies. And I also represent healthy healthcare companies that are looking for purchasing opportunities. So I see both sides of what's going on. I don't focus really on what's going on in the regulatory space, but I do agree with you that there's just got to be much better supervision of what's going on. Reading in the news recently that there's been a bunch of Medicare fraud with the Obamacare situation. And so, see, until these things come under control and there's some adult supervision in the room, for lack of a better word, I think that we're going to find that some of these operators are going to struggle. Like my firm did the Peterson healthcare case, which is in the Midwest. I wasn't personally involved in that case, but that was a large nursing home facility that was basically getting liquidated in pieces. They've been struggling for 2 or 3 years. So we've done 2 workouts for them, and now this is the last one, and we had to do it through a public filing. They were at the end of the rope. And I think that the healthcare situation will definitely roll into next year, because it's going to take a while, particularly for new legislation to be enacted and then the regulators to implement the regulations to try to stabilize that industry. With the hospitality and real estate and what I've been hearing, particularly in testimony in court from professionals like appraisers, certified appraisers, they anticipate that interest rates will continue to come down, hopefully, or folks are speculating that the Fed, Mr. Powell, will reduce rates this week, maybe tomorrow, and that will reinvigorate the freeing up of capital for real estate again. We're seeing in some decrease in insurance rates, not as much as where it should be. That's another industry we could use some regulatory help, I think. But we're also seeing prices come down for labor, energy, and food and beverage, which are like in the hotel industry, you know, that helps anybody in the hospitality industry, restaurants, that those costs coming down, particularly in industries where you can't just turn around and pass those costs on to the customer.
Right.
Right. So there's some hope for that industry next year.
We love a message of hope on this podcast. Yeah. It's not a common one. Right. Like I said, my final question was going to be, what are you looking forward to today? We talked about the healthcare panel, and I think that's really going to be a good one. I'm sure I'll be sitting right somewhere near you in that room. So thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it and hope you have a great day today.
Thank you, guys.
All right, next up from Miami, we have Joel Cohen of Stout, a friend of the pod for longtime listeners. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me here. It's good to cross paths in Miami.
Absolutely. Again, we're coming down to the end of 2025. I would love to get your take on what the story of the year is for you from your practice perspective.
It was an interesting year for us. We hit the typical industries that you and I have spoken about that have a little bit of distress and some of the Chapter 11s that have popped up from those industries. But at the end of the year, we're seeing casual dining as a consistent issue in the marketplace. There are few restaurant chains in this space that are surviving and even thriving. Most of them are having to go into a restructuring of some sort. And we're even seeing some that are revisiting past distress and having to refinance or do other things. And I would just overlay that with interesting fights over confirmation of plans. The plans are becoming more and more complex. the courts are not wanting the professionals to take too much time in constructing these plans. And so we've had a couple of really interesting instances where we come in on behalf of a creditor or two to look at the plan and see if there are things that are thought through as thoroughly as they should have been, or take some analysis and help them understand the plan better in a very short period of time.
It's interesting that you mentioned the casual dining thing, because that came up during one of the networking breaks here where I was discussing with someone else that it actually appears the retail has been a little bit more resilient than we might have thought in March or April when the tariff stuff really started up. And we're seeing a lot of casualties in the restaurant business because they can't insulate themselves as well. You can't stock up inventory when the inventory is perishable food and the labor of chefs, that kind of thing. And we saw a restaurant like Rubio's, they've been bankrupt and handed off to their dip lenders twice in the last, 5 years. So using that as a kind of lens, I'd love to hear what your take is on what you're expecting from 2026.
I think what you're describing is the flexibility of the spendable dollar. You've got a more expensive lifestyle because of all these macroeconomic factors, and pulling back on casual dining is a bit easier than telling the kids you can't have something under the Christmas tree this year, or you're not going to use your Amazon as much as you're used to using it, or go to other retailers. And also, I think retail's had a bit of time to reinvent itself or come up with other things that draw in a sticky customer base. You're like aligned with brands rather than just going to the store and seeing what you might buy. I think they've done a pretty good job of that, considering how bad the outlook was for retail.
The online pivot is a lot harder when you're not a big inventory business.
Yeah, and it's easier to just not go out as much or justify cooking at home versus some of the casual dining spots.
Yeah, I can't exactly cook up a new Xbox on my stove. And I think that we're set up for another really interesting year. It's going to be dramatically different, especially with the complexity of plans and the expense of bankruptcy. I think it's possible that we see just as much distress, but a little bit more reticence for actual in-court restructurings. But has there been anything from our conference here today that's really stood out to you? Or is there something left on the agenda as we record in the afternoon that you're really looking forward to?
I'm definitely looking forward to the rest of the speakers, but there's been a consistent theme among some of the private credit panelists. They are court process. They're anti-court.
Averse.
Yeah, adverse. That's right. They are court process adverse. They really have seen bankruptcy costs so much, and there's this push to do prepack or to negotiate out. And our phone is ringing more for out-of-court restructuring matters, doing an analysis, a fulsome analysis to help structure outside of court leading into the next couple of months rather than preparing some of our clients for filing. So it's been interesting. They've said that, echoed with what our own firm's docket has on it right now. And that's a real push.
Absolutely. Thank you again for all the time. And as always, we'd love to hear from you.
Thanks for having us here. It's been a great conference and really glad we could sit down.
All right, here again from Miami, here we have John Thompson of Akerman. And this is going to be a familiar question at this point, but I'm really curious from your perspective and from your practice, what has been the big takeaway, the big lesson of 25, because we're looking down at the end of the year now?
I guess there are two lessons. One is that I've done an awful lot of work for acquisitive firms and funds that is up from what I had seen in more recent years, right? Probably the last 5 or 10 years. And that tells me that there are opportunities out there, and there are an increasing number of folks that are observant that there are opportunities to be had. And that sort of dovetails with point two, but I've done it for some strategic buyers that are in the industry and looking to pick up advantageous assets. I did it for a company that's a large plumbing and HVAC concern in Canada that wanted to buy assets, and it turned out assets in Georgia and the state of Washington. They turned down the assets that were in Florida. I don't know why. And I've done it for a firm fund in a number of instances where they're looking to put to work small dips, what we would recognize as micro dips below $10 million for purposes of acquiring some advantageous assets that they can improve and resell. But this is the piece too, is that I've done an awful lot of work for some debtors. And frankly, as I was mentioning to Stephanie earlier, they've got too much debt. to file for subchapter 5, but not enough money to actually file for 11. This is not a new problem, of course, but it really tells me that there are an awful lot of middle market and lower middle market companies that are experiencing distress. I think that the private credit markets, no matter what anybody says, are going to be seeing increased stress in their portfolio companies. I suspect that's going to mean an awful lot of below the radar workouts. I suspect that if Congress acts to increase the debt cap, what we're going to see is an awful lot of companies taking advantage of the subchapter 5 solution, because the alternative is, in my experience, not terribly beneficial. There are some, of course, good outcomes under state provisions of ABCs. I've seen and used those effectively. I guess the big thing is I think that there are going to be an awful lot of workouts to be done, and a lot of folks that are going to be busy without perhaps the private credit market making it express that this is the way they're solving it.
And the presence of opportunities is actually something that we've heard in other conversations throughout the day, which is almost in a way a sense of unexpected optimism about some industries might not have been as distressed as we might have expected 9 months ago. There's openings in other places, distress in new places. The market for private credit is going to still remain relatively hot. But going into 2026, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but do you expect any significant changes from this kind of thing that we've seen so far in 25, or is it just more of a continuation kind of situation?
I do expect some changes, and I think some of those are going to be spurred on by a phrase I only heard one time today, but the geopolitical overtones have to be affecting the marketplace. I think that we talked a fair amount about tariffs. I just saw that the president authorized, I think, a $12 billion bailout for farmers, for family farmers. Inflation rates coupled with tariffs, coupled with what looks like the administration's or the president's capability to remove heads of independent agencies, is going to cause a great deal of uncertainty. And as we heard multiple times today, and as we always hear, uncertainty is not the friend of markets. And I think there is going to be a great deal of uncertainty moving into the future. I suspect that probably for different reasons than many others expect, that the Fed chair's replacement, when Chairman Powell departs the Fed next year, is going to be met with a lot of excitement about what's probably anticipated to be lower rates. I think that might be a sugar high, in that I think that there will be some who will be anticipating what has been an inflation rate that's been brought under control, losing its footing again. I don't want to be overly pessimistic about this, but I do think that there's a lot of wood to chop, even if we don't see the wood piles out there yet.
Yeah, what a catchphrase to wrap it up.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate the perspective that you've given us, and thanks again for joining.
Okay, sure. Happy to be here. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
And welcome to our final segment for our little DebtWire Miami roadshow. We are here with Maria Picard from Paul Hastings to do our last set of takeaways from 2025 and our kind of entry points for 2026. So welcome and thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Like I said, what's been the story of 2025 from your perspective or for your practice?
So personally, I think the most interesting thing that happened just before Thanksgiving, which was the Altice refinancing of its $2 billion B6 tranche and the company launching an antitrust lawsuit against its co-op members at the same time. I think this really marks a shift in where things are heading in this market and how the various players are going to be thinking about things going forward on other deals as well. This is the first time that we've seen a credit facility with a true anti-cooperation covenant in it in the new debt that Altice issued just before Thanksgiving. And it's the first time that we're seeing a really large scale co-op group like this get taken to court and potentially things not going the way that people have really been expecting them to. We've really seen a massive proliferation of co-op agreements, and there's obviously a spectrum of them out there. But this is the first time that anyone has really challenged it, and the first time that the challenge really looks like it might have some legs.
And the prevalence of co-ops has been a theme here at this forum. There was an entire panel talking about it, and it's been a topic that popped up in several other conversations. As we look forward into this new coming year, how closely do you expect players in the market to be watching this lawsuit, and what kind of downstream effects do you think it can have on, to use your phrase, the proliferation of co-ops? Does this have the potential to scare that away a little bit?
So I think it depends. I think if this survives a motion to dismiss, that's really when things will get super interesting for everyone. And there's a split, I think, in the market as to whether or not the arguments are strong enough for it to go beyond the motion to dismiss. But assuming it does, and perhaps even if it doesn't, I think it does create a certain amount of pause. It gives people a certain amount of pause in that for the first time, we have to actually think twice about what we're signing. And law firms will potentially have to provide their clients with a lot more guidance as to what is and isn't permissible in a co-op. I think there's a huge spectrum of different types of co-ops. The Altice one had locked up 99% of the funded debt of the company and had really made things very difficult for the company. On the other end of the spectrum, we see smaller co-ops that adjust with a minority of the funded debt or just one tranche of the debt. And so perhaps this isn't going to be so much of a test case across the board, but rather how extreme can you get before things start to get dicey?
Right. And even that will be very instructive for the broader market, which is the setting of guidelines or the throwing up of guardrails. And in a way, that's can be viewed as a little bit of a continuation of all the litigation outcomes that we've seen with the LME action the past 18 months, 2 years, which is we've seen a really large body of work from the courts in terms of, like you said, be careful what you sign. And that goes all the way back to the introduction of what some people would call like a CERTA protection. And now maybe we'll be looking at Altice protections in a year or so.
Yeah. I think the idea of various blockers, we started out with a Chewy protection, J.Crew blocker. And since then, we've had a host of other types of blocker provisions come up in documents and clients asking for things that are named after the various deals being through an LME. And it becomes an exercise of having to recreate these protections in every single deal. At the end of the day, not every credit agreement has these, and they're still very much in the minority. But in the Altice debt, we did see an LME blocker as well. And so I think that is one thing that people are trying to come up with, an all-encompassing tool that can really help protect against any situation, which is very difficult to do. But I do wonder whether that becomes more the norm going forward, even perhaps in new issuances. We've seen them a lot in post-LME documents, but we haven't seen as many of these protections in fresh credit docs. But perhaps 2026 is the year that we see more of a trend towards cautious drafting.
Right. We'll see how things heat up when we get to the dismissal stage. But thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate you sharing your insight.
Thank you for having me.
A special thanks once again to all of our guests for their expertise, their time, and their varied thoughts on a really interesting year. We're hoping to do more of these episodes from future DebtWire events, so to our listeners, stay tuned. If you'd like to attend in person, keep an eye out for future announcements, including for our return to Miami next December for yet another restructuring forum. As always, you can subscribe and find more episodes of DebtWire and of Legal Lens on their respective Spotify or Apple Podcasts pages, as well as more insight on DebtWire.com. Happy New Year, and we'll see you next time.